Would you pray with me? God of signs and words, lead us to Jesus and let us see ourselves in his light. Amen. Please have a seat. Well, good morning and Happy New Year. I went out west to visit my family, and so I did not get the chance to say Merry Christmas to you in the thick of the season, so Merry Christmas to you as well. And speaking of Christmas, by far the best part of Christmas for me this year, other than my mother's turkey gravy, which was exceptional as always, and getting to see the sparse landscape of Saskatchewan without all of the trees and buildings that Ontario likes to put in my way, it was so good to huddle up in a corner of the family living room with my eldest niece as we both held books open and read the hours away. She, it seems, is trying to usurp my place as the one lone bookworm in the family, but I'm glad for the company. It's a new thing for her. My mom says that in November, when the grandkids came to visit, it had been a long day, so she put the three of them to bed early in the evening, went and checked on each of them 2.5 hours later, and when she got to my eldest niece's room, she opened the door and found on the bed a blanket tent pitched, illuminated from within. And my niece had snuck in a flashlight and was tearing through page after page of book 6 of Harry Potter, right? She's got good taste. That's one of the finer ones. Probably, my guess is that each of us in this room, one way or another, or most of us, know something of that experience, right? That leads to binge reading or binge watching. The feeling of being tugged along into the late hours by the motion of a good story, and especially by the momentum of a good mystery. How good are those moments when you read, when the rug is pulled out from under you? I'm talking about it's the butler or the cabbie or all the passengers on the train that did it moments. I'm talking about the Harry is a horcrux, I am your father, Mr. Darcy's not actually a jerk after all moments. These moments where you come to a point in the story that makes you reread everything that went before and makes you realize that something else has been going on in the story beyond what you'd imagined. You get swept up in surprise. And that is what today is. Because in the Christian calendar, today is the payoff at the end of a mystery novel. We call it Epiphany, which is a word the Greeks used to describe the dawn. An Epiphany is the rug pulled out from under you feast of the Christian year. It's the entryway into the season of surprise that follows Christmas. It is the light bulb aha moment when we hear the voices of the prophet Isaiah and the jailbird Apostle Paul, and the biographer of Jesus, Matthew, chime in together to say, look around you. The light is here in the darkness, and God's best plot twist has just unveiled itself in the form of some sketchy pagan astrologers, which means that it has everything to do with you and me. So let's actually walk through that story that we've just heard again, and take it surprise by surprise. We start in Jerusalem. Jerusalem, which is the center of Israel, the home of the Jewish people, and the only city that God promised to save come morning. Thing is that when we catch up with Jerusalem, it's been a very long night. Not only had they seen people peeled off into Assyria and Babylon and come back into the land and slowly rebuilt something of a life, but in the hundreds of years since that miraculous return, they have been under the thumb and shadow of one empire after another. Israel's name stays the same on the bottom, and the name on top just keeps changing. Cyrus in Persia, Alexander in Greece, Caesar in Rome. And they've been in the dark so long that you can understand if their eyes have begun to adjust to it. And if they've lost a little bit of hope that the sky would actually lighten the way that it's supposed to. And this city today, when we catch up with it, is frightened, says our text. Literally in Greek, shaken, rattled. They are unsettled by the news of a bunch of foreigners who have come and are snaking through the streets speaking in a weird accent and in a language half shared with the inhabitants of Jerusalem about a king of the Jews who's been born. One born king of the Jews. And that phrase is likely to wake up an ancient memory in these people. The memory that they have been promised by God through the old prophets, that there was going to come a king to end all kings, that a child would be born to them, and that the government would be on his shoulders and not Caesar's and not Alexander's and not Cyrus's. And yet, the city rouses and seems to go back to sleep. We hear no more other than that they are startled. There's no parade. They send out no search party. And it's actually a bit of a puzzle why. It might have something to do with who the messengers are. This is not exactly who they were expecting to bring the birth announcement when the Messiah showed up. It's a little bit like having a casual acquaintance mention very casually something about your best friend's dinner party, assuming that you had both been invited when you had received no such invitation. But hidden here is a surprise that goes unseen by Jerusalem, that these strange astrologers who've come into town, they're not a red herring in this story, and they're not a piece of cruel irony. If you squint at them, they share the exact same outline as a promise that's been left dangling in some lines from the book of Isaiah. Arise and shine, for your light has come, and the nations will come to your light, and they will bring gold and frankincense. Meanwhile, these strangers catch up with Herod, King Herod, king, though not of the line of David. And Herod knows it. And if you know something of his life and his exploits, you see the way this works out for him, because he does everything in his power to try to get a grip on that power. On the one hand, he cozies up with the Roman overlords. And on the other hand, he undertakes these ambitious building programs designed to announce to the people once and for all that he's the one who's going to make Israel great again. And when these strangers show up and talk with Herod face to face, he hears the news and it hits his ears as a threat. And he knows that he's one baby away from being demoted to the position of so-called king or former king. But rather than yield his crown, rather than become a pilgrim himself and bend his knee, he sends the travelers on the way and helps them while feigning piety and plotting murder. And all of this intrigue and all of these surprises cluster around the biggest surprise and the most puzzling mystery of the story, which is these strangers. Who are these people? Well, there's a lot we don't know. We don't know how many of them there were. Tradition says three. The story is silent. We don't know that they're kings exactly. And wise men's not even necessarily the best translation. The word we're given is magi, which means something like magician or a diviner of omens, soothsayer. More than likely, or as likely as anything else, they are court astrologers consulted by one of the foreign powers, maybe from Persia, maybe from Babylon. And whether they look like the kind of exotic and colorful characters we know from our Christmas cards, or whether they are more like the haggard pilgrims you find in T.S. Eliot's poem, The Journey of the Magi, we know two things about them for sure. One is they are anything but Jewish. And the second is that they are readers of the starlight, that they have been under the cover of darkness, trying to see what the stars say is going to happen next in the story. What is it exactly that makes them pluck out a single star from the Book of Constellations and follow that star over hill and valley all the way to this tiny nation of Israel, to the city of Jerusalem, to search for a king that's not theirs, that they have not been waiting for, to their knowledge? What is it that makes them listen when they speak to the official custodians of the Jewish scriptures, who give them the name Bethlehem as the next clue in the journey, and they actually go. We don't know that either. We do know that the Jerusalem priests and the Bible scholars in residence there tell them the answer and yet fail to go themselves. Because then as now, it is always possible for any of us to point the way to Jesus and fail to go ourselves. You have to wonder, were they surprised when they rounded the bend and saw the little town of Bethlehem perched right there? And when they went into town and found their way not to palace courts, where they might expect to find a royal dignitary, but to some small, maybe one-room house in some poor or working-class family just trying to settle in for the night? Were they surprised? Did they recognize who it was that was perched on Mary's hip? Did they see there the King to end all kings? Did they see there the one person in the world who is bigger than the world? The one who authored and named the stars that they had followed to get there? We don't know. What we do know is that these travelers came in and their well-traveled knees bent as they took out from their bags gifts of gold and incense and ointment, and they laid them before this king as though he was their king. And we are not told, but my hunch is that they were as surprised to be there as Mary was to see them, given that she was probably in the middle of Jesus' bedtime routine. And after a whole schwack of surprises, one after another, that this woman has lived through, now she has to endure the reality that she's not even in charge of the guest list for Jesus' birthday parties. We do not know what these travelers said to one another and what they thought on their long journey home and what they made of this. But we do know that they were the very first non-Jews to travel, to seek, to find this King of the Jews and to claim him as if he might be their king too. And we know that they were not the last. Some 60 or so years after this strange visitation, we hear the Apostle Paul languishing in a prison somewhere. Taking up his pen, he might as well be singing when he exults over God's best-kept secret in his mind as a loyal, faithful Jew. And he calls it this, the mystery that's been hidden in God for ages, that the Gentiles, the nations, the non-Jews, would be fellow heirs, members of the same body as Israel, claimers and sharers of the promise of the Messiah. And Paul is, of course, talking about his non-Jewish readers like the Ephesians. But surprise, Paul is, of course, talking about Church of the Redeemer. Because I won't take a show of hands, but I'm willing to bet that the vast majority of us gathered in this room today are not exactly Jewish. That we could trace our ancestry from many places, and that we are an unlikely group in the extreme. A bunch of strange pilgrims who come from outside of this story that exists in these scriptures, and have followed who knows what science to arrive here on two- and four-wheeled and underground equivalents of camels, and slipped little precious pieces of paper and coin into envelopes, and offered up wisps already of your own prayers like incense, and bent the knee, and will bend the knee this morning, to this child king, the one born king of the Jews, a child born even to us, which means that if you or I, or we imagined ourselves as the kid under the blanket tent, reading along with a Christmas story to see where the story goes, we're actually sort of wrong. Because today, we are the mystery written in the text of Isaiah and Paul and Matthew. We are not outside of the story, but actually in it. We are God's beloved and long-kept secret, the thing that the author of the world was working up to, as ridiculous as that might seem. We, today, is part of the grand epiphany of God gathering all things to himself and all peoples to himself in all of the dimensions of his love. Thanks be to God.